Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Good evening. My name is Mac, and I am an alcoholic. You know, 25 years ago, I sat on this stage with his brother. Isn't that? Seems like a time thing going on here. I'm very glad to be here. I look around this room. I have a lot of friends here. And I'm very glad to be in Texas. You know, I'm a Texan, too. I was born up in Graham. And I have great, great respect. If I have a little Texas flag, I'd hang it up here. I watched TV the other day, and they were going underground to get those guys. And the equipment that they were using was built here in Texas. The guys running it, most of them were Texas people. Makes me real proud. And everybody who's watched that talked about the miracle. I watched it, and I thought, yeah, it's a miracle, but I see them every day. I went to a meeting with my home group recently, and my sponsor, who I sat by, who also has a sponsor, and I sat by him every week, and we get a lot of guys right off the street still drinking. So we let them stay, but they can't talk. So we got this guy came in, and my sponsor made up these 10-minute chips. You know, they get 30 days, 90 days. He has a 10-minute chip. So he gave this guy a 10-minute chip. And my sponsor said, that guy's breath could have fried a chicken. And I saw a miracle the other day. I saw him take a one-year pig, you know. So we get so used to it in AA that we accept these miracles right up front. I'm very glad I'm here. And I'm glad you're here, too. I'm glad my wife came with me. We heard a lot about a love story here tonight, or last night. And Kay and I have got to live one. We live a love story. I met her here in the program, and we've been together 35 years, and we lived a love story. I have a little house on the side of the hill up in West Covina, California. I look up into the San Gabriel Mountains. Be hot down there with us. I can see snow on the mountain. And, you know, my neighbors like me. Yeah. And I got a neighbor that I'll be gone, and he'll, trash can of man will come, and he'll take my trash out and put it back. And that wasn't the way it used to be with me. My neighbors get mad because I drive across their lawns to get home. I'd be out there in the front yard, wired on Benny's mowing lawn at 4 o'clock in the morning, you know? And I don't do those things anymore. And what a freedom. What a freedom. On June 15, 1966, 44 years plus minus some days, a guy brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he didn't tell me it was AA. I was sitting by a building, and I was drinking, and I'd been on about a 2 or 3 weeks drunk, and this guy was sent over there by his sponsor. He said, why don't you go talk to that guy and see if you can help him? You got problems? Go help that guy. So this guy came and sat down and talked to me. Great big guy. He had a shirt off. He had two big eagles on his chest. And I was shaking so bad, I thought those eagles were flying, you know? And he saw me shaking, and he said, "You know, Mac, I think you could catch a hummingbird." He said. And I thought, you know, why are you joking with me now, man? I'm in bad shape here. But he told me something that day. He said, "You know, if you don't drink anything today and tomorrow, I'll come and get you and take you to a place where you never have to have another drink as long as you live, if you don't want to." Now, he 12-stepped me. I didn't know what he's doing, but that's what he's doing. And he did a good job. Because, man, I wanted to find a place. Because I gave it all for booze. I mean, every loving thing that I ever wanted, dreamed about, or had, I gave up for the right to drink. And this guy's telling me that he knows a way out of this mess. And he looked good. He, big guy and husky. So I went back to my room, and I waited the next day for this guy. Now, he didn't tell me what time he's coming to get me. So I waited all day. And I'm sweating, and I'm needing a drink, and I'm pacing. I don't want to ever forget this. My sponsor tells me if I forget it, I'm condemned to relive it again. I don't want to forget it. But I waited for Danny that day. I didn't know his name. But along about dark, that's all I remember, was there's a knock on the door. And this guy came in and said, "You ready to go?" And I went with him. I don't remember saying a word. We marched down the street called Anaheim Street, a tough street in the harbor area in Los Angeles. And we went into a union hall. And we sat down. And it was a table. It was a big place like this, but there's a table over in the corner. And it was 10, 12, 14 guys sitting at the table. So the guy took me over and set me down and got me a cup of coffee. And I was shaking so bad, I couldn't pick it up. But I looked at these guys sitting at the table. I didn't know what it was. And I've heard people say that I've been in AA for years, and I never met anybody that I drink with. It's not true with me. I knew everybody at that table. I knew every damn one of them. I'd been to sea with some of them. When I was a kid, I was longshore, I worked with them, I'd been in jail with them, I fought with them. And they were all sitting at this table. So finally, this one guy who seemed to be the leader asked if anybody wanted to read out of this book. And it was a seaman there that I'd known most of my life. And he was drunk. And I'd never seen him sober. So it was nothing new. So they gave him the book and he tried to read. Now, I didn't know what he was reading, but today I know he's reading chapter 5. And he'd read for a couple of minutes and then he'd cry. He got on a crying jag. And I'm sitting there and I'm watching this, and I didn't know what it was in for. And finally I thought, you know, if he don't shape up, pretty soon they're going to throw his butt out of here. So he cried some more and he read. So finally I thought, if he don't shut up pretty soon, I'm going to throw him out. You know? So Scotty finally got through chapter 5, and then the guy said, "Is there any alcoholics here?" Everybody at that table raised their hand, except me. I pushed my chair back from the table, and I just sat there and looked at him. I couldn't say nothing. I thought, man, it has come to this, you know? And I sat there for a while, and they talked, and finally the meeting was over. And what I remember, one guy asking me a question. He said, Mac, why did you come here tonight? I didn't say anything. So he said, I'll tell you why I came. He said, I came here tonight, Mac, because I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I thought, damn, that's exactly the way I feel. I was just sick and tired of being sick and tired. So the meeting was over. We all left, and we're walking back to the place that I stayed. And I asked this guy, what is this going to cost me? Everything I ever ran into had a price tag on it. Now, what is this going to cost? Because I don't have any money. I've drank it all up. And he said, we won't worry about that. He says, all you do is don't drink anything tonight, and tomorrow I'll come and get you, take you to a big meeting. So there'll be about 20 people there. Yeah. So I don't remember nothing about the next day except I was sick, I was shaky, and I wanted some help. Long about dark, this guy shows up again. And we got in his car this time and went over to Long Beach, California. Went down behind a Goodwill store in an alley behind this Goodwill, and there was an AA meeting. And about 20 people there. And I'll tell you something, they were not impressed with me. But those guys in that Union Hall on Broad Street in Wilmington were impressed with me. And I'll tell you how impressed they were. They were so impressed with me that they let me make coffee for them for the next 3.5 years. And I became the coffee maker for the Broad Street meeting, you know. And that was my introduction into AA. And there's been a lot of water on the bridge since then. That guy that had the magic, that guy that was floating, he was on fire with AA the day he 12-stepped me. I watched him get rich. He made so much money. He bought a new home down in Orange County. Bought a big new car, and he had all that stuff. I went to his house the day the man landed on the moon. And we sat and watched the guy on the moon. And then I said, Danny, why don't you go to a meeting with me tonight? He says, I don't have time. I'm too busy. I just bought a new company up in Seattle. I got to go up and see. He hauled his trucks or cars off the docks, big carriers. He said, I'm too busy to go to AA. So I moved away from the waterfront about that time, and I was 5 years sober, and I lost contact with him. A few years later, after Kay and I was married, we're living in that little house up on the hill there in West Covina. You got to see it. Some of it, you've been to my house. And you look up and see the snow on the mountain in the summertime, and just a nice place. And I got a phone call from a guy down in Long Beach. He said, I think you ought to come down here and see what I found in the park. And I went down, and my friend Danny, he had seen him laying on a park bench. And he got out of jail that morning and sold a pint of blood. And he drank it up, drank up the money. And so I got brought Danny, brought him up to where I live, and I put him in a 12-step house. And I tried to help him get back to get that magic. He could never get it back. A few months later, I got a call from a hospital there in town, and there was a ambulance had went out and picked up a guy that they thought had tried to commit suicide on an overdose of pills. And when they got him there, they went through his shirt pocket and they found the phone number, and it was mine. So they called me, and I went over, and Danny was strapped to a table. And he was screaming and yelling at him about the service they were giving him. Yeah. And I said, what the hell do you care? You ain't gonna pay for it anyway, you know? But I tried to talk to him. He wouldn't talk. They took him away to a mental institution for, I think, a 72-hour hold. And some way he got away. I've never seen him since. He lost that magic. One day I got a phone call from a guy who had 35 years of sobriety. And he had moved up to the Central Coast around Santa Barbara and above there. He bought a big home out on the beach, and his wife had passed away, and so he took all of his money, went up there and bought a home, and he went to a meeting, and it was only a one-hour meeting. Our meetings in Southern Cal are an hour and a half. He didn't like that. Nobody called on him. He didn't like that. He didn't put his hand down. He was used to taking and not giving. So he quit going to meetings. And then he got that attitude back. And then he drank again after 35 years. I went up to see him the day he got out of the hospital. Nice home down on the beach. And he's sitting at the kitchen table with a big book signed by Bill Wilson. He had another one signed by Chuck C., who had been his sponsor at one time. But none of that kept him sober. He forgot to remember where he came from. He forgot to share it with other people. He lost it. Now, I saw him in Hawaii when you were over on the Big Island. I went over there and I saw Bill over there. And I think he has 5 or 6 years now. But he went from a good, healthy-looking man to walking death when he came out of the hospital. And I have to remember those things. And I won't ever forget them, you know. I was brought to Alcoholics Anonymous by Danny, but I worked my way there. And it was over a period of years. I was born to Pierre Graham. And when I was 5 years old, my father got killed. I don't know if I was living there or not, but he got killed. And they shipped me off to Arkansas. There's somebody here from Arkansas. They shipped me off to my grandmother's rock farm. My grandmother raised rocks. Don't laugh. She had 90 acres of them. And I was a kid growing up out there, and they would plow those fields, plant a crop, the rains would come, and all we had left was rocks. So we went out and piled them up, and then I thought we raised the damn things. You know? And Charles sent me a picture one day of a house looked just like my grandmother's house. Had a tin roof, had a big sign out in front, says rocks for sale. Yeah. I don't know where he found that, but I keep it just to remind me. But my grandmother lived in a place called Sunshine. And that's not too far from Hot Springs, which is a good-sized gambling town. But across that creek where my grandmother lived, a river, Baptist, man. Southern Baptist. The Antioch Baptist Church in Sunshine. And my grandmother was a wonderful woman. She loved me. She told me every day. But I didn't understand and I didn't believe her. And her and I used to walk to church. And we'd be walking down this dirt road about 2 miles to the Antioch Baptist Church, and these people ride by in their car, and they wave to it. And me and my grandmother walked to church. And then we'd sit in the front row, and they'd tell us how much they loved it. And I didn't believe them. Now, I didn't look in that car and see that it was full when they went by. It didn't make any difference. They didn't stop for her. About a half a block from that church, they were always singing, "When We All Get to Heaven." And they'd start off with that. And I, as a kid, I thought, that, by God, that's what this thing's all about. This is all going to be over one day, and we're all going to heaven. And I used to go down, they call it a creek. Out in L.A., they call it a river or something. They call it a creek, and about every 2 or 3 weeks during the summertime, they bring the Baptists down. Now, I'm not putting the Baptists down. I think this is Baptist here. Huh? But they bring the Baptists down, and they dunk them in this creek right next to my grandmother's rock farm. And I'd stand on the bank and I'd look and I'd watch them. And they didn't look any different after they dunked them than they did before. I couldn't figure this thing out. So I used to go up this creek and there was a red clay bank up there. I saw a big one coming up here, just like that. So I go up there and kick big clunks of red clay off in the creek and muddy up the water for the Baptists. Now, I'm only about 7 or 8, and I've never had a drink yet, you know? Did that tell you something? Yeah. I had a grandfather. He loved me, too. My grandfather had a knife, and he used to cut everything. He kept it really sharp. And I'd go to him, and he went into a well. Some dynamite went off, busted his eardrums. So he couldn't hear. But I go like this, that means I want his knife. And he'd always give me his knife. I go cut a whistle or whatever. And one day I cut into a piece of wood and had a nail in it. Cut a big chunk, busted a big chunk out of the blade of that knife. So I cleaned it up, wiped it off, went and gave it back to him. I didn't say anything. A couple of weeks went by, and he didn't say anything. So I figured it was safe. So I went back, and I asked him for your knife. He didn't say a word. No. And I was so mad, because I knew that he knew what I knew, you know. And as I left that front room in that house, his keys were laying there on a table. He locked up everything. He locked locks on locks. And as I went by, I picked up those keys, and I went across the front porch. I threw them in the well. I haven't had a drink yet now. That old man looked for those keys. They got to be here somewhere. And he looked for them. And finally, I went and helped him look. Yeah, you ought to be here somewhere. And then one of my cousins, I told him, and he said, "The water's going to start tasting like iron." I said, "Oh, God." So I used to run the bucket down, get some water, and taste it, see if it's tasting like iron. And, oh, man, I don't know how many years he looked for those keys. But after I got sober in AA, I went back to Arkansas, went out to a little country cemetery, sat between him and my grandmother, and I told the old man where the keys were. Yeah, pretty good. Yeah. I had a lot of other problems. I live on a farm where they kill animals. And I couldn't stand it, especially when they killed the calves or something. And I'd run away. Now I'm 7 or 8. I'd go off in the woods and wouldn't come back. He'd send somebody for me, hunt me down, bring me back. I had an uncle who's a few years older than me, and he's tough as nails. And he said, "Ken, I'm going to teach you how to stuff those feelings and become a man." And he taught me. He didn't say, "We're going to do this or that." He said, "We're going to stuff those damn things." And he taught me how, and I could stand by this trough where the blood ran into the blood tank, and I could stand there and not cry. I'm 7 or 8 years old. Stuff those feelings. I'll tell you something. I went through life stuffing feelings, and when I got so full of them, I couldn't stand them, I poured some whiskey in on top of them, hold them down, those feelings. That's the way it was. I left my grandmother's farm and went to Hot Springs. I don't know if anybody's ever been there. It's a gambling town. Racetrack, gambling, bars, ladies of the night, the whole thing. And I thought I went to a different world. From out on that farm where my grandmother didn't even allow a deck of cards in her house. A gal couldn't wear red. And I went into a town that was wide open during the 30s. And man, I loved it. I thought everybody lived like that all over the world. I learned how to read a racing form when I was about 10 years old. I used to bet a nickel, dime, and a quarter bookie out behind the racetrack. Yeah. And I think the word was hustle. I learned how to hustle. They had two trains coming into that town and none going out. Had the Rock Island, Missouri, and Pacific, they both came in and stopped. And they left every night at 7 o'clock. And I go down and hustle the train depot. I get me a pair of shoes with a hole in the toe, a pair of pants with a hole in the knee, and I go down and get me some magnolia blossoms off of somebody's tree, and I go aboard the Rock Island, Missouri, and Pacific, and I'd sell magnolias. I hustle. And I made enough money. When I was 13, my mother and I left Arkansas and came to California, 1940, 41, I think. I was born in 28, so I was about 13. And my mother went to school and became a welder. And I hustled the union halls and the docks, and I loved it. I found out that I could hustle the streets in the union hall and carry luggage off the passenger ship, whatever. I could make more money in an hour than you could out there on that rock farm in 6 months. And I loved it. And I learned how to hustle. And I tried going to school. And I remember I used to sit in my schoolroom, and I'm about 13, and everything was going on outside. At that time, they had a squadron of P-38s, and they used to fly over and practice surf in our little, scrape in our little town. And then they had the big guns in Fort MacArthur to fire out to Catalina every afternoon. They're launching ships, blowing horns. And I'm sitting in school thinking, this stuff is going to be over before I get out there. And I ran away from home, or I took off when I was 16, went to San Francisco, and went through maritime school. And I started going to sea all over. I shipped and drank all over the world. And drinking wasn't a problem. You had a guy here from Houston named Charlie. I knew Charlie out on the coast. Charlie started when he was 15, I think. He went on and became a captain. And I don't know how the hell he did that, drinking the way I was drinking. They sure didn't let me be a captain. I heard a guy say he was on the Valdez. And he said when they wrecked it up there in Alaska, the captain was drunk, Mac. And I said, hell, I've been on a ship where everybody was drunk. We didn't wreck the goddamn thing, you know. Yeah. Everybody's drunk. But I went to sea, made a lot of money, drank all over the world, some of the best watering holes from New Orleans, Post Office Street in Galveston, Texas, one of the wildest little towns that I went through as a young man. It was wild. San Francisco's got their Embarcadero Street. San Pedro had their Beacon Street. And I loved it. I loved drinking. I loved the way of life they gave me. I became known as a young man that would do anything that you needed done around the waterfront. Back then they said, he'll hold his mud. That means he'll keep his mouth shut. And I did what they needed to be done. And I made a lot of money. They put a gambling ship off Long Beach in 1945, 46, I think. And I went to work aboard the gambling ship. They went to Hot Springs, Arkansas to get the dealers and the stuff to man that ship because Las Vegas was just a little spot out there then. And I made more money than I ever dreamed of. Met a little girl from Torrance, California. Bought a home, had a couple of kids, and life was good. Alcohol wasn't a problem with me. I'm not one that stands up here and tell you, I picked up a drink one day, had one drink, and my life went to hell. Wasn't that way with me. I used and abused alcohol for 20 years, or better. And every day for a long time it got better, you know, every day. I used to make them mad when I first came to AA. I said it to somebody here today. And I watched her face. Guys used to say, I bought 3 6-packs, and I drank one every 15 minutes, and I was drinking 3 of them a day. And I'd say, you're so goddamn busy counting, you didn't know how to get drunk. I said, I drink beer when I wasn't drinking. I get a beer drinker mad, I'll tell you. But I'll tell you the truth, I buried some real good beer drinkers since I've been here. I've been pallbearers for quite a few beer drinkers. Kill you just as quick as the other. But I wanted an image, so I said that. And it was true. I used to own a cocktail lounge out in Carson, California. And we bought that place because me and my partner needed a place to drink after hours. So we'd go open up anytime we want to, 4 or 5 in the morning, have a drink. And I'll tell you something. I used to go in and sit at the end of the bar. I'm the owner. The bartender would go down, pull a little draft and bring it and set it in front of me. Somebody would say, hey, give Mac a double shot of this or that. I'd say, no, I'm not drinking today. And I'm sipping on that beer. And it really was the truth. When I got down, I wanted to get downtown. And I didn't have time for all that going to the bathroom 40 times. I had a good life for a lot of years. I drank up that first wife and those kids, that house. I got another wife. Got another house. Got some stepkids. Got me a new lawnmower. I went out there and mowed that lawn. My neighbors get mad because I mow at 4 in the morning, you know. And I ended up in the Marine Corps. We were talking. Marine Corps fighter pilot right there. My joy. I was a basic infantry man. He gave me a BAR. And I think the average life of a BAR man in combat was about 15 minutes. But I was in a spot, I call it an alcoholic dilemma. I had one. And I was sitting, and it's just getting dark, and about an hour I had to go out and do guard duty out there. And I knew, because I've been drinking all day, that if I went out there, I'd go to sleep. And I knew if I went out there and went to sleep, it was going to be a hell of a pay. So along about 10, 15 minutes before I went out, this guy came over, and I guess I was showing the stress. So he came over with a little white pill. He broke it in two, gave me half of it, and I drank a cup of coffee. He said, now take the other half, and right before you go out there, you get another cup of coffee, drop his other Benny. I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'll tell you, I went out there that night and I guarded. Three days later, I'm still guarding things. I'm guarding things that don't even need to be guarded. And I thought I discovered a miracle drug. I thought, my God, I died and went to heaven. Drop a handful of wipes, wash it down, some good booze, get you downtown. But it gets you out of town, too. Yeah. I lived in a little town called Wilmington. It's on the, between Long Beach and San Pedro. It's tucked in there on the dock. And quiet little town, but mean little town. And I just lost my train of thought. But I lived there. I really did. Oh, I got up one morning, and I had to go to San Pedro. Now, it's about 3 miles over to San Pedro. So I drop a handful of wipes, wash it down with some good booze, and I'm going to San Pedro. And I don't know, on the bus or standing at the bus stop or something, a guy came by and he said, where are you going? I said, going to San Pedro. I said, where are you going? He said, Seattle. So I went to Seattle. Huh? Yeah. Those things get you moving. I gritted my teeth out. These are cleats. I mean, I'm telling you, we used to buy those things. You'd drive down the freeway and you'd look up into an 18-wheeler and a truck driver would be sitting up there. He'd been on the road 18 days, you know. So you just follow him to the next scale and buy a roll of those things for a couple of bucks. And away you go. And I think they got me to AA a lot quicker. Man, they burnt me up. I drank up that second wife in that home. And I ended up living in a flop house on Anaheim Street, Wilmington, California. And because of what I'd done for the union and the way I'd worked for them, they let me run for president of a local, a new local. And at the age of 29 years, I became president of that local, strong local, big local. And 3.5 years later, the same guys that came and celebrated with me and drank good scotch the night I got elected, they came in with a letter from San Francisco. And a guy named Harry Bridges was president of the International. He took my job away from me. And for a while, I'd be walking down the street of Wilmington, and I'd see you coming up the street. I grew up there. I knew everybody in town. I'd see somebody come and I knew I'd cross over the other side of the street. And the reason I did it is because I couldn't remember what lie I told them the last time I saw them. Somebody would stop on my side and offer me a ride, and I'd say, no, I'm just going down to get my car out of the shop. They knew I didn't have a car. That wasn't the bad part. The bad part was I knew that they knew. You know, that was the bad part. And that's the way it was with me. And I'm the type of guy who used to sit in bars, look down, and somebody would be passed out across the end of a bar, or some lady pass out in a booth. I'd say to myself, if I couldn't hold my whiskey better than that, I'd quit. So I became the thing that I most despised in other people. Guy that couldn't hold his whiskey, couldn't keep his word. I'm the guy who started the 4-day work week, you know? Yeah. My boss asked me one time, he said, why do you only work 4 days? And I said, because I can't make a living in 3, you know? Yeah. So I did it all. I did what was necessary for me to do as a young, budding alcoholic who still had some ego and pride and stuff going, and I gave it all away. I was at a meeting in the 502 Club in Covina, and we have a big banner on the wall that says, I want you guys from Lake Whitney to hear this. It says, Sobriety Capital of the World. And we have a banner to prove it. And we've flown that banner at world conventions and went in. Can't help you, buddy. And a terrible thing happened to our group a couple of years ago. About 150 of them got mad about something. We have 500 cups on the wall. If you remember, you had a cup. And they went and got those cups and went down the street, ran in a hall, bought a coffee pot, and started another club. They called it the Other Club. Now, there's a certain way you say that. If you just don't know, you just say the Other Club. But if you know, you say the Other Club. Like, we'll get them. We'll get them. Anyway, I'd like to tell you about my sponsor. He's a big Irishman, three-fingered roofer, and he has 52 years of sobriety. And the guy that's a master, has the big chair in our meeting, is a guy that has 62 years, who 12-stepped John 52 years ago, you know. And they have a row over there for these guys. And when I got 40, they let me move over into the row. And what's that mountain? Mount Rushmore. They call it the Mount Rushmore section. Yeah. And it's fun. It's fun to go over there. And if I'm not there, like I won't, I'll be here Wednesday. But if I'm not there, I can let somebody sit in my chair in the Mount Rushmore district. You know? And every once in a while, they call on us for advice. You know? It's great. It's about 50 guys. We meet every Wednesday at 6:30. And you never seen such love between men in your life. And John's been my savior. I met him 44 years ago. Some guy told me, he said, there's a guy over there talking at a meeting, sounds just like you. He's been all the places you've been. And I went over to listen to him, and sure enough, he had. He'd been merchant seaman. And I was in Galveston, Texas. I just paid off a ship when Texas City blew up. Anybody remember that? Yeah. Biggest man-made explosion outside the atomic bomb. It was right down there in Texas City. And he was trying to get on a ship, so he went to work in the rescue. And they gave me a book of that, and I could see a picture of John's brother, my sponsor's brother, in there working. Quite a history. And him and I just sat and go over the good time. And I moved away from the waterfront in 1971. And the reason I moved is because I was getting in a lot of trouble, sober. I've had my nose broke 5 times. I got it broke the last time in AA. When I first came in, it was a little crooked. And this guy, last time, he straightened my nose. I don't know if we can count that time or not, because he did a little surgery on me. But I still can't breathe. Anyway, I got in a lot of trouble. So I got a call from the International up north. They said, why don't you just pack everything in, get a withdrawal, move out of the way. Going up to the valley, we got a job for you. So I went up to San Gabriel Valley, where I live today, in West Covina. And I went to some guy on the waterfront I was working with, and I said, where's West Covina? They want me to go to West Covina. He said, I don't know, Mac, but I think it's out in the desert. And so I moved out in the desert to everybody down there. And they gave me a good job. They found a good job for me. I negotiated a labor contract for a company that was having a lot of trouble. They had 3 unions, and nobody could get things together. So I put together a program that got everybody happy, stopped the Wildcat strike. The guy loved me. He told me, you got a job for life, boy. And then he got in trouble financially. He had to sell the company. And I'll never forget when he came back from New York. He sold the company and he came back and he set us all down. He says, I didn't have enough clout to protect any of you. I got what I needed to get out of here and survive, but I couldn't protect you. And I was the first guy they fired. Yeah, because I had the union experience along with management experience, and they didn't want anybody around. So they fired me. And that was about the time I met Kay. And I'm 10 years sober and out of work. And so I decided to go back to school. I didn't want to go back to the waterfront. I had no education. So I went to school. And thank God for Kay. I used to take my lesson. And we would take out 20 words that I didn't know the meaning of, and we'd get a dictionary, and we'd work it out. And I'd study those. Then I'd study my lesson. Then I'd go to school at night. And I ended up in the mortgage business, you know. And I sat in school and took tests, and I'd look around at all these young kids and their college degrees and stuff, and I thought, I got to compete against them when I get out there? No way. Anyway, this program will let you compete against anybody. I don't care who you are. This program, used in the way it's meant to be, will let you compete against anybody on any job. And after a few years, I made some good money. The same bank that I'd gotten a lot of trouble. When I was working with a union, they call it when you mix two funds together, commingling. But it really wasn't commingling because I didn't have any funds. It was just were just theirs. You know? So anyway, I got out of there. It cost me a lot. It cost me my pension, a lot of other stuff. But I ended up in Covina. I met Kay, and she come carrying a bunch of baggage with her, a little 40-year-old girl. And I thought, my God, my family's up and raised, and here. So I went to my sponsor, and I, at that time, I had him for 32 years before he died. I asked, his name was Eddie Cochran. He's one of the guys four guys that started Narcotics Anonymous. And I went to Eddie, and I said, what am I going to do? I met this young lady, red-headed Irish gal, and I'm in love. And we got this 4-year-old kid. And he said, Mac, we've had you around here for quite a few years, and we taught you how to treat people. He said, why don't you take Kay home, that little girl, and you treat him like you would a newcomer in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, I've seen you go clean up after a guy or lady has spilt their coffee. You go clean it up and get them another cup. He said, take them home, treat them like that. And we have. And we've lived together now for 35 years. Neither one of us has had to pack up and leave. Tell the other one to get out. Yeah, I've been told they better go see your sponsor. Yeah. And I called her sponsor up one day and I told her, you know, Al-Anon's out there big on birthdays. I said, she cannot have a birthday anymore. And she said, why? And I said, because she had a slip. He said, really? And I said, yeah, she was nice to me 2 days in a row. We speak Al-Anon up there at the house. Got a phone for him. I catch him on my phone every once in a while. And I turn him into Al-Anon's central office. But I live a good life. I live a glorious life. You know? A glorious life for a guy like me. Isn't that something? You can too. I'm a product of these steps. Running a little bit over, but I'm going to talk about these steps for a minute. In my opinion, I heard them here today. The steps are the key that takes place here that unlocks the thing inside. Somebody mentioned it. It's like taking a bath inside. You ever get out of jail? First thing you do is go home and get in a bath in the shower and try to get that, whether it's been 10 days, 2 days, 30 days, get that feeling away from me. But how about the inside? And that's what this inventory is all about. Giving you a chance to discover the person you've been drinking with. And that's what happened to me. I discovered I damn near killed a pretty good guy. You know? I come that close to killing a pretty good guy. Yeah. I've had my face kicked in, ribs broke, hands broke, and I never taught me anything. But I'll tell you, when I got in there, in here, and started discovering about this kid and what I had to do, I had a chance to see Bill Wilson one time. I was playing cards, and Harbor area place, and a friend of mine came in. He said, Bill Wilson is coming to Long Beach to speak tonight. He said, go get cleaned up. I'll take you over, and you can meet Bill. And I had a couple of pretty good hands, so I just said, I think I'll wait and see him the next time he's in town. I have people all the time say, with your sobriety, you must have met Bill. I said, no, I could have. But I didn't. So don't miss anything around. But I'll tell you what I did get to do. Lois came to Palm Springs in the 70s. And I forget what just exactly, but I got a picture of her taken. We took her out of a wheelchair and set her on a Harley. And she's sitting on this Harley, and this big guy from the South Bay Bikers Group, let's see, I'm trying to remember their name, whatever, Fifth Chapter was the name of this group. And this guy's bike was out there. So somebody ran in and told him, said, Lois Wilson is sitting on your Harley. So he came back and took his wings off and gave them to Lois and stood behind her, and I got a picture, him and her on a Harley, you know. And I didn't get to see Bill, but I did get to do that. I've lived a glorious life. I've been to meeting all over the world, from New Zealand to London, Ireland, and I have a seat here. I have a seat in AA, and I've earned it, and I think that maybe that chair there. No, that's my sponsor sitting there. I went to see my sponsor the day before he died, and I told him, Eddie, we're going to miss you. And he says, I ain't going nowhere. He says, when you go to a meeting, you look around and you see an empty chair, I'll be sitting in it. So you got to step by my sponsor, you know? That's a treat. Anyway, that was something, that guy getting up here, remembering the whole Fifth Chapter, wasn't that something? Yeah. I heard a prayer once. A guy from another English Irishman from New York came to Palm Springs, and he had a prayer. And I took a copy of it and I listened to it. And I don't know when I learned it, but I learned that prayer. And it goes like this. It says, I seek my God in the morning when my day is at its best. And his presence come like sunrise, like a glory on my breast. And all day long that presence lingers. And all day long he stays with me. As I sail through troubled waters over a very calm sea. Now other ships were torn and battered. Other ships were sore distressed. But the winds that seemed to guide them brought me to a peace and rest. So I think of other morning with a total remorse of mine when I too had released the mooring and left it all behind. So I think I know a secret brought by many a troubled way. You must seek God in the morning if you want him throughout the day. You were doing it. Normally when I'd say that, I would say, God bless you. But with this group, I can see that he already has. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.